Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You're listening to a special episode of the TLS podcast, and as well as, rather than instead of, our normal weekly show. Here, our fiction editor Toby Lischtig speaks to George Saunders about his sensational new novel, Lincoln in the Bardo. And that's fair use of sensational, given the critical swooning surrounding its publication. You'll find exclusive extracts from the novel, along with accompanying readings featuring a cast of celebrity fans, on our website. Toby's first question to Saunders was why he decided to introduce a supernatural element to an otherwise simple tale about President Lincoln mourning his dead son, Willie.
Years ago, I had written another novel, in quotes, that was set in an upstate New York graveyard. And it was sort of inspired by the early chat lines, you know, the way that you'd have these kind of interrupted, misspelled, agrammatical narratives. So I had that kind of in my mind. There was also in the middle there a play that I tried to write that had the ghost in there. So I think the short answer is that given the subject matter of Lincoln being in a graveyard alone, you just needed a narrator other than Lincoln. That would be a big buzzkill to try to narrate from Lincoln's point of view. You know, it's funny when you talk about the way ideas evolve. When you're talking professionally about it, you tend to oversimplify. But in reality, there were probably three or four different strands going on over 15 years that led me to do it that way.
And so had this novel been in your head for about 15 years or so?
20-ish, yeah.
Wow.
It was just, we had heard that, or I'd seen that crypt back in the Bill Clinton era, actually, that, you know, the crypt at Oak Hill, and I'd been told that Lincoln had entered there.
And that's the crypt where his son was interned.
Right, and you can actually see it from a fairly main road in D.C. You know, at that time, it was one of those ideas that felt like someone should be able to write it, but I didn't think it was me. It was a little too earnest at that time for my, you know, my bag of tricks. So I just kept kind of pushing it off. And whenever I felt kind of artistically happy, that idea would present again, like, hello, are you ready for me? So it was only in 2012 that I thought, I still didn't think I was quite ready, but I felt like kind of, you know, now or never. And it also felt a bit like an artistic crossroads. Like if I didn't try it, I would somehow have conceded the rest of my life being repetitious, you know, that,
right.
You know, if somebody really wonderful comes along, you kind of halfway fall in love with her, but you think you're not up to it. So if you say no, then you're that guy, you know.
It was now or never.
It was now or never, given my advanced age. I didn't want to be the person who goes to his grave and finds that the stone says, decline to do that which you must long to do.
And the novel itself, we were approached to the girl, is anything but earnest. I mean, it's fantastically playful. So it was obviously the right time to write it. And perhaps had you tried that 20 years ago, it may have ended up being the wrong kind of novel.
No, that's exactly right. You know, a work of art has always an implicit problem. That's what helps you finish it. So in this case, the awareness that it might be too earnest, you know, forced me to bring in other valences. But I think there was a lot of, you know, it's funny, I hadn't thought of this in a while, but about 7 years ago, I did a nonfiction piece where I went to live in a homeless camp in Fresno, California, kind of incognito. And so much of that helped me write this book, because it was, in some ways, a similar platform. It was a confined space. It was an old train yard that was actually fenced in. A small cast of characters. And one of the things that was really similar was that the people in the camp felt bad about being there, and they tended to justify their presence there with these sort of repetitive narratives. And it only occurred to me in the last few days how much of that is in this book.
And perhaps they've been sort of thrown together there without too much sense of volition either. Maybe it was a sort of a place that had brought them together, but they weren't natural bedfellows. Was that also part of the...
Exactly right. And kind of this, there was a tendency to repeat two or three narratives. And the point was often to distinguish that individual from the other people there. Everyone else was there for good reason, but they were there exceptionally. But it's interesting the way these things kind of create a work of art. I mean, I think in this phase when we're trying to articulate where a work came from, it tends to be, you know, we look for the simple answer, but I can name six or seven things that have been happening over the last 15 years that kind of led into this book in a funny way.
And what was it about the image of Abraham Lincoln and his recently deceased son Willie in particular then that kind of allowed these ideas to coalesce?
Well, I mean, the truth is I'm not sure. It was the longevity of that image. It was sort of just beautiful, haunting, but mostly it was just, it kept coming back to me. I would sort of push it away, and at odd moments I would just, it felt like a bit like a portal into some kind of beauty I hadn't been able to access yet. But the symptom of that was just that, you know, every time I'd have some little artistic victory, part of me would say, okay, this is what you want to try next. So, I mean, I could reduce it and say, at the moment I heard about that story, there was a kind of a melding of the Pieta and Lincoln Memorial that appeared in my mind, and I don't usually think visually. It was also, you know, I was a young father myself at that point. Also, this is during the Clinton scandal years, so it was a little bit mind-blowing that Lincoln could and would make his way out of the White House alone. So all of those were kind of contributory things, but I've learned over the years that there's a certain feeling that I get from an image or an idea or a vague notion, and it's kind of, it feels like bounty. There's some kind of promise of verbal overflow in that mode, and it's often not conceptual or thematic. It's just something, a feeling that is intriguing and promises that if you turn your mind to it, there'll be a lot there to work from. So, I mean, the skills that a writer accrues over the years are pretty pathetic, really, but one of them is just that sense of being able to distinguish between two ideas and know that this one is going to be fruitful for reasons that you can't quite understand yet.
And maybe don't even need to understand. Maybe that's the job of critics.
Yes. In fact, I would say you have to try to resist the urge to understand
right.
it, because when you understand it, you tend to, you know, over control it in a certain way.
I mean, it's set during the, obviously with Abraham Lincoln, it's set during the Civil War, and I'm sure I'm not the first person to have noticed that your first ever collection of stories was called Civil War Land, which is set to, the title story of which is set in a Civil War theme park, which is populated by ghosts. And I just wondered if there was something about the way the Civil War still haunts America today that you keep coming back to as well.
The Civil War is also in that category of ideas that just light me up for some reason. I don't really know why. But I will say, the more I read in it, the more I realized that war never ended, actually. You know, you can see it here now in this Trump stuff. You can see it here in the racial inequity that we have. So the short version is the Civil War ended slavery and then did nothing whatsoever to address the economic situation of the former slaves. So in that way, it's very much alive here. And I think the basic divisions of that war are still in place. And the way Lincoln said it approximately was that, you know, there are people who are willing to eat the fruit that someone else grew. And I think that's still the case here. There's quite a strange division even now. So the book was finished before this Trump stuff started, but it just feels kind of, it sort of felt like it was coming out of that division for sure.
Yeah, and the division which itself has, you know, created the political circumstance of the day. Yes. Do you think that's something that's appreciated enough in the States, the kind of the effect of the Civil War? I mean, do people talk about it enough for your liking?
Well, I think most people talk about it in a sort of nostalgic sense, you know, this heroic time when we finally, you know, refuted slavery. But I think the idea of the botched Reconstruction is not understood here as much as it should be. In other words, the slaves were freed and given absolutely zero, despite the billions of dollars of value that they'd made. Here, it's kind of a gone with the wind idea, maybe. That although I will say there's a wonderful documentary, James Baldwin documentary called I Am Not Your Negro, that's getting a lot of attention here, and that really seems to have done a lot to sort of wake up, especially the younger generation, to what has actually happened here over the last, you know, 300 years.
So the tide of consciousness is perhaps changing a little bit.
You got to hope, yeah. but I guess we've thought that before. You know? But I mean, this is one of the things about this book that, you know, as a middle-aged dude, you know, the pull to history is pretty strong. Working on this book and then following it right away with some reporting on the Trump campaign, it kind of made me, I guess, just newly aware of the fragility of America and the fact that for all of our talk, we never really have done what we said we were going to do in the Constitution. So there's a feeling in me, and I think generally here, of kind of a renewed awareness of democracy. In other words, my generation probably completely took it for granted. And in the younger generation now, they're very alive with political thought. And I think it's a pretty amazing time to be here right now. So many things that seemed taken for granted are now suddenly really being looked at for the first time.
That leads nicely into a question I wanted to ask about goodness and the notion of the collective good, which I think you definitely approach in the book. And, you know, you've got these wonderfully idiosyncratic ghosts who in death have become even more idiosyncratic, sort of sprouting eyes in one case or wandering around in a cumbersome state of arousal in another, but they eventually all come together to perform a collective task, which I won't give away for those listeners who haven't read the book yet, but it's a collective task to help someone. And you've described this plotline as arguing for a viral theory of goodness, which is something I'm very intrigued about. So I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that.
The one thing is that wasn't part of the design of the book, but it kind of happened and through revision, so it was a surprise to me as well. And it also implies the opposite, a viral nature of evil. My thought is that the book sort of shows and maybe argues for the idea that the smallest action actually has a great deal of import, since that small action could be multiplied by, factors of thousands or a million. And I'm feeling that here right now in the States. You know, the way things are going, there's so much craziness going on at the top with Trump and so on. And I think people are starting to realize that the only way to fight that is by each person resisting at the 95% level in whatever his or her flavor is. So in other words, there's a little frustration that the media is somehow not quite equipped to fight this thing. They're trying, but there's a kind of a strange insularity between the power and the media that's frustrating when you're on the ground. But as was seen like in that Women's March, the one thing this administration seems to respond to is any downturn in its popularity. So I think people are feeling strangely empowered, and this viral nature of goodness seems to be part of it. If each of us decides to resist and not become inattentive to resistance during the course of a day, it actually seems to be making a difference. And so paradoxically, I think it's making people feel more empowered and more alert to the real idea of democracy, which is that the individual consciousness actually matters. But as a trope, as a fictional trope, you know, it was just one of those things that appears late in a project that you've been deeply inside of for a long time. And I kind of looked up one day to go, oh, that's interesting. You know, all these people are, the ghosts in this book they're a bit like longtime city dwellers. You know, they're a little cynical, a little selfish. And at certain moments in the book, each of them sort of comes alive out of that and then contributes to this effect that you're talking about. But it was totally accidental and kind of spontaneous.
And, I mean, now that that's happened, I mean, as a writer, as a fiction writer, as opposed to a journalist or an American or a human being, do you feel compelled now more than ever to kind of engage with that concept of goodness? I mean, is it how, you know, do novels need to be moral, and do they need to engage with those concepts of good or evil, especially in troubling times like now, or is that not a necessity, do you think?
I think it's a positive result of a work of art, but my experience has been you don't want to try it, you know? In other words, a work of art, I think, has to have the right to be entirely useless, or for the writer not to know what the use of it is. I think most works of art, even very dark ones, ultimately fulfill a purpose of some kind of moral power. But my experience has been, if that sets out to be your plan, you'll make something that's reductive and facile. Better to open up to the thing via technical means. In other words, trying to make people and voices that are interesting and that are truthful and that are rich and all those things. And somehow, in my experience, if you focus on the technical, then the moral ethical, like some kind of forest creature, will slowly drift out of the woods. But if you look directly at it, it runs off. You know, I think the worst thing is some kind of overtly propagandistic work of art, because in a sense it's anti-art, you know, to say I've got a truth and I want to pull, you know, a truck full of that truth over to you and dump it on you.
It's a closes down narrative sort of, rather than opens it up, I
guess. It violates the contract between reader and writer, which is essentially one of intimacy, you know, and mutual respect. So my sense has been, as a person, I'm very interested in good and evil and life and death and all that, but it seems to me you just work on trying to make the fictive reality undeniable to your reader, and all of that will sort of take care of itself more naturally.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
On the subject of life and death, I know you've written before about Buddhism and your relationship with Buddhism. Obviously, the bardo of Lincoln in the Bardo is a Tibetan word for purgatory or limbo. So I just wondered a bit about, if you could talk a little bit about how your own relationship with Buddhism has gone into the book.
Well, I think I might have been a Buddhist before I knew what it was through the writing practice, because essentially my game has always been you get up in the morning, you look at what you did yesterday, and there's a magic moment there where you try to forget what you thought about it yesterday, and you just read it, and you sort of see, you know, what the energy of the piece is. To me, that's fundamentally meditative. You know, you go to a party, you think it's going to be A, it actually turns out to be B. How long does it take for you to lose your connection to the party you thought you were going to and actually be at the party you're at?
Constant reincarnation.
Yes. So that seems to me that predated my actual interest in Buddhism. And then my wife and I have been aspiring Buddhists for about 15 years, and I'm quite, unfortunately, quite casual about it. But some of the ideas that I've encountered have been very formative, and also some of the people I've met, you know, the people who are more serious practitioners and teachers, if nothing else, you know, in this lifetime, I got the sense that there's a range of ways of being present in the world, from very, very aware, almost beyond one's ability to imagine that level of awareness, to down where I am. Sometimes I think the sacred is just a matter of having us, maybe it's a few minutes of heightened awareness or heightened spirituality, and then ritually reminding yourself of that for the rest of your life. So I think this book is sort of that. The bardo in the book is not at all the one represented in Tibetan texts, but the book was kind of a way for me just to, you know, in a sense, remind myself that death really is coming, and whatever happens there, it's probably not what we expect.
Amid such deeply serious themes, I mean, it's a brilliantly funny novel, isn't it? I think it's hugely funny. I love the whole conceit of the self-deluded ghosts being in denial about being dead and referring to their coffins as sick boxes and to being alive as less sick. I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about humour and how you use humour in your fiction and the kind of the importance of it, I suppose.
You know, I teach writing at Syracuse University here, and we have these incredibly great students. So I've noticed in my students and in myself that, you know, a person has several gifts that they used to negotiate life, just as a human being. So in my case, I've always been very emotional, maybe sentimental, and also have been inclined to be funny, just partly because I grew up on the South Side of Chicago, where that's kind of the way you express love is by insults. But so early in my writing career, I thought the idea was to suppress both those excesses and try to be more normal, and then discovered, actually, no, that at least in my case, what an artist does is, you know, call out all the things that you are, all the strengths and weaknesses that you have, and then somehow through artistic practice, train those things to play nicely together, to kind of co-enable in a certain way. So what I find myself doing in conversation and in writing is to be very earnest, maybe unbearably earnest, and when it gets too unbearable, I puncture it with a joke, and vice versa. So it's in a sense, it's like riding a bike. You know, you get leaning too far to the left, what do you do? Well, you know, you lean to the right. But having said that, I think it's more than just that. My basic sense of things is that the distinction between funny and serious is an artificial one. You know, you can, here in the States, you know, you can walk out of a funeral and find yourself in a strip mall where there's a, you know, a Chuck E. Cheese franchise with a guy in a giant mouse costume coming out for a smoke break, you know. So it seems to me that at the highest level, their tragedy and comedy are sort of artificial distinctions that we put in place to make life more bearable. But in reality, I don't feel that separation as much as I used to.
that's very interesting. So it's not like you start off from a position of earnestness and try and weave the jokes in. It's just that the whole thing is inextricably linked, I guess.
Yeah, a very sad person can fart in an elevator.
And that will always be funny. Everyone has been talking, as you can't help have noticed, about the fact that this is your debut novel after two fantastically successful decades of writing short stories and journalism. And I just wondered what it was that made you want to turn this into a novel, or whether this was a novel to begin with, and whether there's going to be more novel writing from you.
Really, you know, after all that time, I had kind of learned to avoid a certain mode, which is, it's a mode I would get into when I thought I had a novel in progress, and I would give myself permission to sort of go on and on, you know, to do a 15-page section about the closet or something. And I'd gotten into trouble several times with that. So my mantra was just always make everything as brisk as possible, pray to God it's a short story. Don't worry about a novel, you know, because a short story is such a beautiful form. And in some ways, I think it's more difficult than a novel, and it might also be a more truthful reflection on human experience. So when this started, I really was sort of talking to the book to say, look, please just be as short as you can. And actually, the book is about 60,000 words. The format kind of pads it out a little bit.
But that's still much more than a novella. I mean, that's kind of short novel.
Yes, yeah. I had about a third of it written and really revised and revised. And then I kind of said, well, that, you know, it looks like we're only about an hour and a half into this 7-hour night. So it was, in other words, it became a novel with a lot of resistance from me. And my plan when I'm done with this is just to go right back and write a short story. That, in other words, my stride has always been more short story stride. And as much as I enjoyed this, I would have to go right back to that anti-novel position. And, you know, if another idea comes along and convinces me, I'd be more than happy to do it.
But you're not out searching for it.
Not at all.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.